You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Harold Ramis Film School in Chicago recently celebrated its first graduating class. We'll talk to a Sheboygan native who was in that first group of graduates.
First, deadly wildfires are raging in Northern California, strengthening today as winds pick up. The wildfires have killed at least 21 people. Authorities say they've located more than 100 people who were reported missing, but 560 are still unaccounted for.
Here's a woman in Calistoga, California, driving through her neighborhood. This audio from CNN.
This is my neighborhood in flames. Completely in flames.
John Hopewell is the earth science specialist for the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
John, how and where exactly did these wildfires get started?
Well, they started in Napa, Sonoma, Mendocino County, the areas north of San Francisco. For background information, California just went through 5 years of some of the worst drought on record, followed by extremely wet winter this year, which provided a lot of rain to grasses and fine fuels, which had a bumper crop. And then actually we went into a serious drought situation over the summer and into the early fall is typically fire season in Northern California, what's called Diablo winds down in Southern California. They're known as Santa Ana winds. But a high-pressure system sets up over to the east in Nevada, and winds flow down from the Sierras into the coastal areas. High winds that get accelerated by the canyons, and if there's an ignition, and 95% of fires in California are started by man, either intentionally or unintentionally, there's an ignition source. These fires spread incredibly rapidly. 79-mile-an-hour wind was clocked in Sonoma County overnight on Sunday. So these fires started locally. The sources are unknown at this time. We don't know exactly. We know there weren't thunderstorms in the area, so it's not lightning. I think most likely we're going to find out that it was human-caused. It could be arson, or it could have been unintentional.
What do you think it is about the wet winter that wasn't enough to keep California from being quite so dry when it went into another period of drought?
Well, you know, it's kind of they got all that rain and then it just got completely dry. So there was just the ground was loaded with fuel. You got to remember also there are a lot of dead trees from the 5 year drought. Somewhere around 10 million dead trees in the entire state of California. So it was just bad luck that they had a bumper crop of fine fuels and grasses going into what is normally their fire season.
Now, officials have said that one of the challenges with these fires is that sometimes they're ignited overnight, so people might be sleeping when the fires are started. They don't catch them right away. How quickly can this happen? It seems like as soon as you catch it, it shouldn't be out of control yet. What about that factor, the surprise factor?
Yeah, that was a major contributing factor, and why probably we're going to find a lot more than 21 people dead, you said in the lead-in, that 560 are missing. And a lot of that could be because of communication breakdown. But the seminal event in California was the Oakland Hills fire back in 1991. This now, what we're referring to as the Columbus Day firestorm, happened 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, 1 in the morning. It caught people in bed and totally unsurprised. I also heard one report that in Santa Rosa, the emergency alert system was activated, but it didn't transmit. So people didn't hear it on their weather radios or text messages.
I've heard the media reporting who are on the ground that firefighters in these California fires, they're in the mode to save lives. It doesn't sound like they're necessarily focusing on containing it or putting it out. What does that say to you?
That says to me that it's a dire situation. Tonight it's going to ramp up again. There's red flag warnings, which is severe fire conditions, not only in north of San Francisco, but down south of San Francisco as well. So people should be alert tonight and monitoring the news, because we could see another firestorm tonight, and hopefully people will not be laying in bed.
Talking to John Hopewell right now, earth science specialist for the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post, talking about the devastating wildfires in Northern California. And John, this is being built, and you described some of the terrain here as the wine country, Sonoma, Mendocino County. If the fires continue to spread, what areas are going to be in danger next?
Well, you know, these winds swirl. They predominantly come out of the north and northeast, but it's rugged terrain. It's mountainous terrain. There's canyons, and you can get spot fires from embers that are being blown miles in either direction. It's almost like a tornadic type event, but on a huge scale, where winds are swirling all over and dropping embers almost randomly. So it's very hard for the firefighters to put containment lines in these type of conditions, because fires can hop the containment lines. They can go around them. This is an extremely challenging fire for firefighters to combat.
This year seems to be especially bad for wildfires. We've had incredible natural disasters with hurricanes in Houston and Puerto Rico. Now the wildfires, we already had a batch that we reported on earlier. Is this an especially bad year for wildfires?
Yeah, it's been a bad year up in the Pacific Northwest, and in Montana they had near record wildfires. It's, again, California, this Northern California situation has the same background as the fires up in the Northwest, where we've had an extremely dry summer after a wet winter and an excessive amount of fuels. But the Western U.S. has evolved with fire. Northern California is what's known as the chaparral. It's scrub oak. It's scrub sage. It depends on fires to come through and burn off and regenerate with ash. What we have now is what's called the wildland urban interface. So where fires used to just burn through unpopulated areas, now it's burning through Santa Rosa. They took a huge hit. Suburbs are expanding farther out into the chaparral, exposing people to more chance of fire. So it's a above average year for fires, but the ecology, the Western ecology, has evolved with fire. Unlike the East Coast, Appalachian Mountains, those forests are not as linked to fires as the Western forests are.
Is there anything going forward that we can do about where we build and the kind of landscapes that we cultivate that could make the area, particularly in California, as we look at the fires there, that could make that area less susceptible to this kind of catastrophic damage?
Yeah, there are. And insurance companies do require homeowners in certain areas to create buffer zones, to take down trees within certain feet of a structure to make sure that there's not available gasoline and sheds to explode, stuff like that. It just depends on where you are, what the municipality requires, what the insurance companies requires. But we could do a lot more.
Now, when we talked to you last, we were talking about some of the smoke that was being generated in the Pacific Northwest from the fires out there and in Montana, and how it was affecting weather in fairly faraway parts of the country. Are we going to see the same thing with these California fires?
The situation's a different. I don't see these, because the jet stream is much farther north currently during these fires that are burning. But San Francisco is absolutely choking on smoke right now. The Bay Area Air Quality District has put out an alert for what's called 2.5 p.m. It's a particulate matter from smoke that's so small that you can inhale it into your bloodstream. The areas in Santa Rosa and Napa and Mendocino are also, the air quality is atrocious. People are being told to stay indoors with filtered air. So the smoke situation is as bad as it was in Portland and Seattle, and maybe even worse, but it's more of a localized issue this time around.
John, thank you so much for joining us again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was John Hopewell, Earth Science Specialist for the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post. He joined us there to talk about the devastating wildfires in Northern California. They seem to be getting worse today with increased winds. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet a Sheboygan native who is among the first class of graduates in a new film school devoted to comedy.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
100 years ago, Wisconsin went to war. In partnership with the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, we're exploring stories from Wisconsin men and women who served in World War I. Today, John Haddock, a Milwaukee native, tells us about his enlistment and training. The tape quality isn't great, so you'll hear his voice transition to Peter Sobel reading from the transcript, along with oral historian Ellen Brooks.
The war had been declared, and everybody had the war spirit.
I got the war spirit, and I wanted to be a hero. I was only 16 years old at the time. I went up to the recruiting man on recruiting duty in front of the door outside on the street. I asked him, "How old do you have to be to enlist in the National Guard?" "Gee," he says, "I don't know. Here's the man on recruiting duty that don't even know that." He said, "I think it's 17. How old are you?" I says, "17. So he says, "Well, come on up and see the lieutenant. Here's a lad wants to enlist," he says. The lieutenant looked at me and he said, "How old are you, lad?" I says, 17. "Oh," he says, "you're too young." He said, "You have to be 18. Come back in a week." So I came back in a week and he says, "Weren't you in here last week?" I says, "Yes." He says, "How old are you?" I says, 18. "Swear him in, Sergeant."
John James Haddock was a Milwaukee native. He joined the National Guard on June 7, 1917. His unit eventually became Company F, 127th Regiment of the 32nd Division. Haddock spent a month and a half drilling and learning the manual of arms at Camp Douglas, followed by intensive training at Camp MacArthur in Waco, Texas. Reflecting back on those days at Camp MacArthur, Haddock admitted that he and his fellow soldiers didn't always follow the rules to a T, citing one particular scheme that ended in a hilarious bit of discipline.
This is a cute story. I have to laugh when I think of it. We were so tired out from drilling every day, and I don't know, probably 9 hours, I would say, that we used to lay and take 5 minutes to get dressed, lay till the last minute, then hurry up and get dressed. Then some bright soldier got the idea to put on our long overcoats. We had overcoats, even in the summertime, that reached to our ankles. Don't put on your clothes or anything or your uniform. Just jump out of bed at the last second and jump in and put on that big long overcoat. Put your rifle belt on that and come out and stand reveille with your rifle on your shoulder. Well, that was swell. Even the sergeants started doing it. Everybody was in love with it. Give you another 5 minutes to sleep, laying there anyhow. Somebody tipped the captain off to it. So one morning he stood up in front of the company at reveille and he says, "Well, men, I understand you have a new dress format," he said. "All you men, please remove your overcoats and fold them up neatly and lay them in front of you on the ground." So here was the entire company in underwear, long underwear. We wore long underwear winter and summer. He says, "Well, what do we have here?" "All right, Sergeant," he says to the first sergeant. "You take these men for a little stroll up and down every company street in the regiment," he says. "Let them show off their beautiful underwear for the rest of the regiment." So we paraded up one street and down the other, and how they did catcalls and what have you, and give us the raspberry as we walked in our underwear. So that cured it. None of that went on after that.
Get out your bells, get out your horns, bring all the girls along. Boys are leaving home today, 100,000 strong.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, you might remember Harold Ramis as the character Egon in the original 1984 film Ghostbusters, but he also wrote or directed blockbuster films like Animal House, Caddyshack, and Groundhog Day, just to name a few.
Ramis passed away in 2014. Since then, there's been a film school named after him, which is operated by the Second City in Chicago.
Bethany Berg is a filmmaker from Sheboygan. She was among the first to graduate from the prestigious film school. Bethany, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Bethany, how did you find out about this film school that was under the name of Harold Ramis?
I've been asked that question a lot, and I actually don't really remember how I found out about it initially. I think it was a Google search. I think I was like, well, I want to go to film school. I want it to be in Chicago. I'd like it to be comedy. I wonder if there's something like that. And so I just typed it in, I think, and it came up. And then, of course, after I knew about it, a ton of friends of mine would send me the link, being like, you have to apply. So it was kind of a lot of different little things.
And what got you into comedy filmmaking in particular?
It was the only thing I did that people kind of enjoyed. Everything else, they were like, that's pretty bad. You have to stop doing that. So I would make little funny videos sometimes, and people seemed to like them. So I figured I should probably ride that wave as long as I could.
I understand at the film school, one of the things you did as part of your experience was to take improv lessons. What do you think that, how did that relate to the film, the other film studies you were doing?
I think that improv just kind of helps with life. You kind of learn how to sort of communicate without planning ahead, which is important just when you're having a conversation with, I don't know, your barista. You can't script that out. I've tried. It doesn't work, believe me. So I think that it's good to just kind of have that mindset of accepting things and kind of learning to roll with the punches in a way. I mean, that helps on a film set where anything can go wrong, and it usually does.
Now, it sounds like going to comedy film school would be a barrel of laughs, a fun experience, and I imagine it was. I'm also guessing there was a fair amount of work. Can you talk about what went into this program?
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of work, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was tons. So basically the first session was kind of building our reference level. We did a lot of reading, a lot of watching of films, which doesn't sound like it'd be work, but, you know, when you're, like, critically analyzing films, it does take quite a bit of mental power. And then, you know, we had to come out of it with a short film and either an original pilot or a screenplay. So there was a lot of writing involved, a lot of filming. We were always working on projects.
And what was your final project about?
My final project was called The Great Chicago Fire, and it was about a private investigator who was trying to solve two cases, The Great Chicago Fire and why his girlfriend broke up with him, and he couldn't solve either of them.
And I understand one of your earlier projects was Sheboygan Vogue. Tell us about that one.
Well, as I'm sure you know, Sheboygan is the fashion capital of the world.
Right, everybody knows this.
Common knowledge. I'm kind of obsessed with those Vogue videos where they explore people's closets. And I thought it would be very funny to do that to my 15-year-old brother. And I did, not thinking that I would even use it. I just kind of went into his closet. And it was so funny just how earnest and straight he was that I kind of cut it into this Vogue-esque video.
Had a lot of jerseys in there, a lot of Packers jerseys, it looked like.
Yeah, he likes the jerseys and the khakis, too.
And then when
I asked him if he wore jeans, he got very aggressive and was like, nope, I don't like jeans, only khakis. So
I imagine, I've never made a comedy movie in my life, but I'm guessing that it's one of those things where it looks on film effortless and zany and lighthearted fun, and behind the scenes it takes a lot of work to make that happen. What's some of the sweat that goes on behind the scenes of making a comedy movie?
Oh my gosh, so much. I mean, first you have to come up with a story. That's impossible. And then, I mean, just the set of a movie itself, every single shot you see has been planned and lit, and you shoot that about, I mean, depending on the director, maybe 10 times. So, I mean, there's tons of work involved. I remember one of the first things I ever shot, I had my dad star in it, actually, and we just kind of went around, you know, getting shots, and we went very quickly, but I remember him turning to me and being like, this is kind of a lot of work. I was like, yeah.
Surprise.
So, I mean, you can't even imagine how much, and I'm always surprised by it, by how much work it is.
What were some of the highlights of the experience? I imagine you might have gotten to talk to some cool comedians or film people there. What stuck out to you?
Yeah, I think I just meeting the people in my school. They're so wonderful and lovely and talented, and we're all really good friends still. We have, like, a group me that we still message each other on. So at 2 a.m., I'll get a text from, like, one of the moms of the group, like, about a movie she fell asleep to in the theater. So we're very close. That's been the highlight for me, was just meeting these wonderful people.
And then what's next for you now that you've gone through the Harold Ramis Film School?
Yeah, some of the students actually have kind of formed a tiny little production company. So we're making some shorts right now. I just wrote one that we are producing, so that's exciting. It's a parody of Whiplash, where a little third grader is, like, obsessed with the recorder. and so I'm working on that, and I'm working on a couple of other things. And actively seeking jobs. So if anybody listening over the way give me a job, I'm more than happy to apply.
Do you ever want to turn the camera back on Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of my dreams is to film in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. So,
well, you've got surfing there and your brother's closet, so some good starts.
I know.
So far.
There's so many good things to do. I think the problem is almost choosing what to film.
Absolutely.
It's such a rich literary landscape.
Bethany, thanks a lot, and good luck with your career.
Yeah, thank you so much.
As Bethany Berg, a filmmaker and Sheboygan native, and we've been talking about the Harold Ramis Film School in Chicago and also about Bethany's recent graduation.
Maybe, you know, a zany madcap comedy behind the scenes at a public radio talk show.
Can't believe someone hasn't done that already.
The jokes write themselves?
Yeah, it's almost already a thing.
Yeah.
It's our lives.
Would they be laughing with us or at us, I guess would be my main word.
Definitely at us. Mm-hmm.
Now, ESPN announced Monday that SportsCenter anchor Jemele Hill had been suspended for 2 weeks, saying she violated the organization's social media policy for a second time. She recently made comments on Twitter about how NFL fans could boycott vendors and advertisers associated with the Dallas Cowboys. She was reacting to the Cowboys owner instituting a new rule on player protests.
President Trump weighed in after this announcement, tweeting, "With Jemele Hill at the mic, it's no wonder ESPN ratings have tanked, in fact, tanked so badly. It is a talk of the industry."
Hill had previously made headlines in September when she tweeted that President Trump was a white supremacist.
Paul Hagan is a professor of law and co-director of the Center for Sports Law and Policy at Duke University, and he joins us to dig into the factors surrounding Hill's suspension, her rights, and how they intersect with workplace policies. Paul, thanks a lot for being here.
Glad to join you.
Well, Paul, why did ESPN decide this time around to suspend Jemele Hill?
Well, that you should ask them, but why did they have a right to do that? Is that the question?
Right. Why this time and not the first time?
Well, I think it was a second time, and therefore she had noticed there was greater clarity about what the company's position was. I think also more directly, this time she called for a boycott of the sponsors of ESPN. So it was a direct, a political action statement that directly affected the financial underpinning of ESPN.
Now, Hill had in the past been critical of the president. She called him a white supremacist in a tweet, and now she, with these latest tweets, is wading into the politics of protesting at football games. Is it unusual for a media personality, a sports analyst, to take a stance like she has?
I think that the level of political social activism among all people surrounding sports has gone up significantly in the last probably 2 years. So it is in historical terms unusual, but it is part of what we've been seeing for the last couple of years. And probably matches the president's own use of social media to attack his opponents.
Now, on the one hand, Hill is an individual. She's a citizen with her own point of view. On the other hand, she represents ESPN. Where does that line get drawn when we're talking about a media personality with her own opinions and thoughts and feelings about things? Where does that line get drawn when it comes to her job and what her company is free or has a right to ask of her?
Well, I think there are two separate things that we want to be clear about. One of them is whether it's a good idea for ESPN to do that. ESPN has a vested interest in creating controversies, in having segments of the population who are responding to different views, hearing their ideas voiced. So whether it is wise to do it, I think is one question. The separate question is whether an employer, as part of its employee policies, can restrict certain kinds of speech of its employees. They're at their absolute strongest when it's speech in the workplace, speech using the facilities of the employer. It gets weaker the farther you get away from the workplace setting, but still, especially since what she was tweeting about is very directly related to her role and business position, I think they have a fairly strong legal claim to be able to do it.
What if she was tweeting off the clock, tweeting at 10 o'clock at night when she was home and on her personal phone?
As to, well, again, now we're a little bit, the question is the public likely to treat this as totally separate? Can we have restrictions on things that would lead to confusion? So, for example, the federal government limits what federal employees can say, the kinds of issues that they can get involved in, because of an possible confusion about whether they're speaking as a judicial law clerk, for example, or as a private individual. And I think that that's the central kind of concern here.
And in a post for the site, The Undefeated, at the end of September, and this was before the recent suspension, Hill wrote, "Yes, my job is to deliver sports commentary and news, but when do my duties to the job end and my rights as a person begin?" We've been getting at this a little bit, but looking expressly at the First Amendment, what are her rights?
Well, the First Amendment rights are actually relatively restricted. So originally, the First Amendment was Congress shall pass no law. After the Civil War, that was extended to the states. But it doesn't deal with private employers' ability to restrict speech, at least speech within the context of employment or related to employment. And part of what I think is behind that distinction is when the government acts to restrict speech, it really dramatically restricts it. If a private entity restricts speech, there are other competitors you can go to. Now, with that said, I think culturally we are, as a society, coming to believe that the rights of free speech extend very much more broadly than the actual legal or constitutional reach of the First Amendment. When that starts to happen, I'm not sure the legal position changes, but the way in which the action by the employer is perceived, their ability to attract employees to work under those kind of conditions, all change. So I would expect that ESPN will feel some negative response to this restriction of an African American woman speaking on topics that she thinks directly relate to the welfare of African Americans.
We're talking with Paul Hagen right now, co-director of the Center for Sports Law and Policy at Duke University, talking about the suspension of ESPN's Jemele Hill for a second violation of ESPN's social media guidelines. And extrapolating out a little bit, Paul, about what Americans assume the First Amendment, what their First Amendment rights are in the workplace, is there a correction needed as far as a cultural or a literacy, I guess would be a better term, a basic literacy of what the First Amendment rights entail when someone is on the job?
Well, I guess there are two approaches that we could be taking to this. One is, given that people may misunderstand how broadly their rights are protected, it would be useful to be clearer about that, to have better educational programs, that sort of thing. The other is that we may be in a cultural shift in which employers are going to discover that whatever their legal rights are, they'll do a great deal of damage to themselves if they start interfering with employee speech.
And back to Jemele Hill, she has been tangling directly with the White House, which has been an unusual thing to see with her tweets. And White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders responded, this is to the first incidents a couple weeks ago. Here she is.
But I think that's one of the more outrageous comments that anyone could make, and certainly something that I think is a fireable offense by ESPN.
And Hill saying that President Trump is a white supremacist. What do you think about that coming together of a person who is representing the company ESPN and the White House responding directly? What does that make you think of?
Well, we have a number of issues there. So is this a fireable offense to make a comment that is either an insight or an observation, whatever you want to characterize it? Is that a fireable offense? I suspect that the answer is yes, but that may depend on her contract and what she can be fired for. I suspect that she may be an at-will employee, in which case, comes as a great surprise to most Americans. They can be fired for any reason or no reason. So is that a correct statement? Yes. Is it likely that an employer would want to do that? Well, that's another question. Would the public respond badly? So the president is now taking the position that the failure to discipline is causing the public to respond badly. I don't know that I'm in a position to analyze that very effectively, but that, I believe, is part of the question. What exactly is the limit on the employer? Ultimately, the limit is going to be how the public responds, how the public understand what their rights should be. So to be a little clear, that was the flip side of whether the public should be informed they don't have rights. It could be, if enough people assert that those are rights, that they become, in effect, rights. Expectations of employees, and you can't hire people, you can't retain good people if you don't give them that kind of breadth of ability to speak robustly about things that matter to them.
Paul Hagen with us right now, co-director of the Center for Sports Law and Policy at Duke University, talking about the suspension of ESPN's Jemele Hill for a second violation, the company says, of social media guidelines.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 to talk about the specific instance or the wider issues that have been raised. Was ESPN wrong to suspend Jemele Hill, or is this the right move? Is it acceptable for a figure like her to express her opinions, her political opinions on social media? How much authority, how much sway should employers have over what their employees do, say, post on social media when it comes to political issues? How do things work where you work? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time, WPR.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with the factors surrounding the suspension of ESPN anchor Jemele Hill. Paul Hagen is the co-director of the Center for Sports Law and Policy at Duke University.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this debate, this case at ESPN, the back and forth with the White House? What do you think about what Jemele Hill tweeted, about ESPN's response, about the White House response, and more generally, how much sway should employers have over what their employees can say on or off the job, in person or on social media? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Brian with us first in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi. I think it needs to be said that these individual events that are seemingly unrelated to each other are, in fact, related. They all, at an increasing rate, we're seeing a forward movement towards a singular endpoint, which is fascism. And I think it's time to have a honest conversation about how this could happen, how it is happening, and what needs to be done to stop that and preserve our individual rights.
Brian, thank you for the call. I appreciate that. And Paul, do you see what Brian is suggesting there, a gradual curtailing, drawing back of Americans' rights and civil liberties?
Well, I think one thing that certainly is new and unusual is to have the President of the United States suggest who should be fired. He suggested that football players who didn't stand for the national anthem should be fired, that there should be massive boycotts of entities that don't support certain viewpoints. Could you make an argument that at that point that is essentially the president using his bully pulpit in a way that starts to approach a law? I don't know. I'm not sure I would I'm in a good position to comment directly on the major social trends, but the direct intervention of the president in private employment is certainly new and unusual, and I think, frankly, worrisome.
Ryan, thank you for that call. And we'll go next to Sarah in Stanley. Sarah, hello.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I just wanted to make the comment that people have the right to state their opinions when they're not at work, as long as it's a statement that is not inciting violence or a hate crime or anything like that. But I think that at work that you need to follow whatever rules or policies that are in place, and that there's a place to speak your mind and there's one not to, and that would be at the workplace.
Okay, Sarah, thank you for that. And what do you think about what Sarah had to say, Paul?
I think that's an easier kind of case when the person's workplace and work time is clearly delineated. When you are actually at work in a space, for many people, there's a confusion. When they're speaking on behalf of the company, or when they become so associated with an idea that they endanger the company in various kinds of ways. If you, for example, were to be leave work and, you know, go out into the streets and protest against funding for public radio, it might be a problem. And, I think it takes a somewhat nuanced and complicated response. There are places where worker speech is protected if they're in labor unions. They can, the employers can't interfere with their right to engage in certain kind of speech designed to further the goals of their employment. So there are other things that we have as tools other than the First Amendment that can be very important.
I'm going to jump in, so maybe we can try to get one more quick call in. Let's take Peter next in Plainfield. Peter, hi.
Hello. She's a public figure, and she's going to be held responsible for what she says, whether she thinks this was a private venue, her Facebook page or whatever. She's going to be held responsible. She's a public figure because of her job at ESPN. An example, Juan Williams casually mentions how he feels riding in an airplane where there's people that he identified as Arab origin. He's instantly fired from NPR. She's had a second warning and suspended. I think she knows what she's doing, and they're treating her with kid gloves when you compare that to what happened to Juan.
Peter, thank you for that. And Paul, I've got about 30 seconds. What is your response to Peter's thoughts?
The should is always a complicated question, and I don't want to go too far into should. I think that the is here, the First Amendment does not protect a private employer's decisions about employment decisions, and that can extend to the behavior of the employee outside of the workspace unless there is some kind of protected category or other form of legal or constitutional protection.
And we leave it there, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Paul Hagen, professor of law and co-director of the Center for Sports Law and Policy at Duke University.